Hello, this is recording number 5 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Recording number 4, we stopped near the end of chapter 4, so we're picking up very close to the end, page 38. The Wizard's Hat was a place of considerable reputation, and it was filled with people. The tavern area was crowded with all sorts of men, while most of the tables in the main room were clustered with ladies and gentlemen, eating and drinking, for it was but a bit past noon. A haughty Violet accosted the sweating proprietor and demanded a table near the front of the room. One look at her, and from her, and he hastened to comply. Who knew whose mistress she was, or what influence she had? Anyway, a looker like that near the front of his place would encourage custom. Break. All right, well, we've got a little more information here about the Wizard's Hat, a tavern either in or near the Garden Quarter. I'm getting the sense that it's probably in the Garden Quarter, as that was where Gord and Violet were headed. Some little description, a busy, bustling place at noontime. And a little more about the looks and the influence of Violet. And in this setting, why a courtesan would be considered a member of higher society. What influence she had, whose mistress she was, not particularly her and herself, but the influence that she might have over other figures of authority or power. Okay, restart. Page 38, paragraph 4. I'm sorry, the other section was paragraph 3 that I started with, and we are now on paragraph 4. All right. Once seated, Violet ordered a goblet of cooled green wine from Selene, a place Gord had never heard of. She waved him to a position off to one side, and the ostler brought him a small beer, while she dined on the finest provender of the establishment. Gord was served a sort of slumgullion that the serving maid identified as raw goo. Violet struggled to suppress a smile when he asked her what it was. Break. All right, we have the first mention of Selene, and a cooled green wine from Selene, so something to add to the setting information, a tiny little bit of uniqueness. Selene green wine. We note that Gord has never even heard of Selene, which is, you know, the nearby elven kingdom. So even though Gord is in the slum quarter, he has seemingly been made aware of various things, like being a free citizen of Greyhawk, knowing about ogres and trolls, having a little information about the area around him. But outside of the city, he's even unaware of Selene. We have their slumgullion raw goo food given to Gord since he's just the servant, and the finest food given, of course, to Violet, pretending to be a high society courtesan. We see that Violet, has a little bit of, she gives a little smile when Gord is wondering what it was, showing her like a little sense of humor and maybe her little relationship with Gord. All right, restart. Page 38. Paragraph 5. It's rag out, she said quietly with a stern expression on her face. That's one word. A foreign way of saying it's a thin stew with more vegetables and the like than real meat. Some slumgullion's better, but don't say that here, Gord. Now hush, or they'll cop wise as to where you're from. Ord wrinkled up his nose and was about to whisper a reply when a shadow moved across the table. Violet fell immediately back into character. "Get rid of that sullen face, boy," she snapped. "I shall have you take your fare in the kitchen with the lackeys there. Have you no appreciation for my generosity?" As she spoke, Violet seemed quite annoyed and very much in charge in a mistress-servant relationship. Gord bit back his words and obeyed her, for as displeased as he was about their relative meals and her imperious manner, he understood that she was now up to something. Break. Well, here we show how quickly Violet is able to get back into character, and within this story, it is supposed to be that she is very good at this, a good actress, and very good at getting into these characters of pretending to be, like right now, a high society courtesan. We have a little bit showing how much Gord has changed in the unspecified time period here, where the 12-year-old Gord, starving all the time, is very happy for almost any kind of food. Here he's turning his nose up at a vegetable stew that you know might have even a little meat in it. A much changed Gord from the starving orphan that we're introduced to in chapter one. Now the dialogue, you note, is a little bit incongruous here, where that Violet is saying that they will cop wise as to where you're from. A little bit out of place, I would say, in a fantasy story. I wonder where cop wise sounds more like something from the 1920s than from a fantasy novel. All right, we've got a little bit of information about how things are set up with the Wizard's Hat Inn. We have the lackeys eating in the kitchen, and that it's a honor in a sense for the Gord, the serving boy to Violet, to be eating out there in the restaurant with her. Or on the main floor. It's not exactly a restaurant. Okay, I'm going to restart here. It is page 39, paragraph 3. "Pardon, good lady, but I noted your courage in allowing a serving boy to sup with you. May I be so bold as to suggest that you do so for lack of a proper gentleman escort, and to ahem offer my company?" With that, he made a courtly bow and flourish, adding, "The Honorable Master Ralph, Elder of 7 Mile Mill, at your service." Somehow Violet managed to blush, lower her eyes, smile prettily, and stammer all at once, "Well, sir, or Honorable Master, I should say I am at a disadvantage." "Pardon, my lady, I shall take my leave then," said Ralph. Gord was quite pleased with that turn of events. Before the fellow could turn away, Violet spoke quickly. "Oh, nay, good master, I am most grateful for your kindness and courtesy. I crave your pardon if you felt otherwise. It is just that a proper lady shouldn't converse with strangers. Yet this knave is indeed unfitting company for one of breeding, such as yourself. And perhaps our host will introduce us formally. I shall serve your ladyship, and the boy can be sent to keep company with the scullions. He'd be more comfortable there, certainly. Why, look at him now. A picture of one ill at ease with superiors." Gord was indeed feeling out of place, and angry too, but there was neither word nor deed for him. He sat quietly as the gentleman gestured toward the ostler, who scurried over and performed his role in the ritual. Break. Well, I mean, we're getting a little example here of higher society and their little customs. It seems a strange ritual here, where and seemingly to me a little out of place. The wizard's hat in, I guess, is more upper class than I had imagined. Where it's the ostler is going to be the host and going to introduce this honorable Master Ralph, elder of Seven Mile Mill, and Violet. Although, you know, and a strange kind of thing where Violet, as a courtesan, is being introduced as in the fashion of a proper lady. We get a little more of how Gord feels about Violet, a little more of the atmosphere of the Wizard's Hat Inn, and the introduction of, besides a new character, a new place called Seven Mile Mill. I don't see anything else to pull out of these paragraphs. And I'm going to restart. It is page 39, last paragraph. "Good sir, may I introduce Lady Penora, after being informed by Violet of Divers, again filled in by the fair lady. And to you, my lady, may I have the pleasure of introducing." Ward found all of this to be quite sickening, all the more so because Violet seemed to be really enjoying herself. But when the amenities were over, that was the end of it for Gord. With no further ado, the proprietor put him in the charge of a bustling wench, who, in turn, took him to the kitchen. There he finished his beer and raw goo, and slumped glumly, wondering what to do now. The answer soon presented itself, for several of the scullions and stable boys were gathered near the rear door, rolling knucklebones. Well paid they must be, for each had a scattering of iron drabs, brass bits, and bronze Zs before him. Bronze coins surprised Gord's. These were stakes worth his while. Forgetting about the handsome gallant and Violet for the moment, he moved toward the game. Break. Well, I'm always interested in the Greyhawk currency, and here we're introduced to another low-value bit of coinage. In the past, we've had the iron drabs, bronze Zs, the copper common, and the silver noble. Now, between the iron and the bronze, it seems like we have the brass bits. So, you know, this is quite a series of coinage that is in use right here. First mention of the brass bits that I've seen. We have scullions and stable boys in the kitchens and plain knucklebones. So here we have dice and dice gaming going on. Something to think about to add a little more atmosphere to your setting, a little more color. You know, even something that can be done with a little dice playing right at the table if you wanted to get the characters around it. Again, we have Gord here eating that vegetable stew and drinking beer, and now so far away from the starving orphan that seems to be just poor fare to him at this point. We had that. Even the Gord disgusted with that stylized introduction, but perhaps more because of jealousy about Violet. But we do have, it seems a little stilted, but still something that could be used if you want an example or you know, to see how you could add it to your roleplay campaign. Here's a little more information about how you could have the NPCs or the NPCs act or your characters if they're highborn or pretending to be highborn. So just a little more background and atmospheric information right here. All right, I'm going to restart. This is page 40, paragraph 3. Shuffling his feet and looking as stupid as he could, Gord asked what the boys were doing. Grinning, the leader asked if the inquirer had any money. If so, perhaps they'd be kind enough to teach him a wonderful new game and give him a chance to win a fortune. Gord bit at it perfectly, and soon he was being called by name while taking his turn at tossing the yellowish cubes. He lost more often than he won, but the proceeds he gleaned from his light-fingered work far outpaced the coins he gave up. As the game progressed, Gord worked it, fumbling with coins so as to slip many of the growing number of Z's into his pocket, away from the gaze of those being fleeced out of their wealth. The disappearance of the more valuable coinage was becoming apparent, and one of the stable boys started to ask a question about this, when a shriek came from the common room. Everyone from the kitchen rushed out to see what had happened. Gord joined the throng, but not before he managed to scoop up a good handful of the remaining coins. In the space of those few seconds, an uproar had come over the place. Break. All right, we've got a little example of both ways of a common way of fleecing somebody at dice is that taking advantage of someone unfamiliar, and someone who is a dice sharp here taking advantage of those who think that he is a neophyte to gambling. But in this respect, it shows that Gord isn't just showing them that he's better at the dice. He's letting himself lose so that he can steal the better coinage from those around him. So using his experienced thieving skills while letting him seem like he's still losing the coin. That's a little bit different from the most common way I've seen this done, where the neophyte gambler turns the tables on one last bet and scoops up all the money. This is perhaps a little safer. We're going to restart. This is page 40, the last paragraph. An honorable gentleman from Seven Mile Mill had come staggering down the stairs from the upper floor, gasping and gesturing. As he stepped into the main room, someone saw a knife handle protruding from his upper back and screamed. Ralph turned a bluish hue and expired, falling face down. A babble of questions arose as Gord took in the scene. He heard the ostler shout for Lady Panora, while the wench who had shepherded Gord into the kitchen called out for her charges to find the lady's servant. Gord got away in the confusion and made the street, and used his best skulking techniques to become an invisible boy. He turned east at the first lane, twisted his trail several times to be sure he wasn't being followed, and as dusk fell, made his way back to the rear of the pawn shop. In a matter of minutes thereafter, Gord, rag-wrapped and dirty, was entering the headquarters of the Master of Beggars. Break. Well, here we have a little more about Violet. We don't know what transpired, but definitely like the move of a thief with a backstab there. We have the description of the death of a common, a common citizen, you know, rather than perhaps a leveled NPC. So we also see that Gord has these techniques, his skulking techniques, and is quite prepared to think for himself and of himself as he makes his way out of there without finding out what had happened to Violet. Obviously, they've got a set a set of orders there for a quick escape, and he's off to the pawn shop, and quickly out of those fancy clothes, back to being a beggar, and back to the headquarters of Theobald, Master of Beggars. I'm going to restart here. It is page 41, paragraph 2. Ord found Fergo upstairs already questioning Violet, his face flushed with rage. It seemed she had discovered the gentleman was no town elder at all, but a thief of no mean rate. Violet had found this out when she searched his purse. How did that come to pass? Well, the man calling himself Ralph had led her to dalliance upstairs, but instead of then falling asleep when she feigned slumber, he had slipped soundlessly out of bed, taken her purse, and was just about to do the same with her cheap jewelry, when Violet was sat up and objected. At this, Ralph had drawn his dirk and threatened to carve a second mouth into her throat if she made a noise. Violet had stayed silent after that, but when the thief came over to trups up his victim before escaping, she had done something foolish, pulled out a knife she had secreted beneath her pillow, and plunged the weapon into the thief's shoulder. The little blade was strongly poisoned, and the result was his death scene in front of dozens of witnesses. During the hubbub that ensued, Violet had gotten out a window and escaped, but in her haste she had taken the streets and entered the old town by a gate, so her progress could be traced at least that far. Fergo took her loot and ordered her to her quarters until she was sent for. Then Fergo turned to Gord and got out of him what he knew. Gord also had to give up his hard-earned coins, all but a pair of silver nobles that he had hidden where only the most careful search would find them, and no such search was made. Break. This is the end of chapter 4. Here we see that definitely the death of Ralph, who's a secret thief, in the game, a classed NPC, a leveled NPC as well, who obviously, you know, he dies, but dies from the little blade, but with strong poison. So something that could even bring low a higher level character. So still the way that the story is described still fits within the parameters of 1EA D&D. There is more about here with Violet both being skilled enough to have escaped, but foolish enough not to have, to have been spotted going through the old town gate. Whereas Gord makes it out and into the pawn shop, and then back into this disguise as a beggar, and out of the finery. So where we show that Fergo, their instructor, we can see that they're upset with Violet, although perhaps not so upset with Gord, who, you know, he is able to hide a few coins of the most valuable sort in that lot, silver nobles, even though they're well secreted, perhaps Fergo, perhaps they're so upset with Violet, or perhaps they're so, pleased with Gord that he isn't completely searched and is able to keep those coins for himself. We see here the beginning of the open conflict between the beggars and the thieves, and the thief, although not obviously not realizing that Violet was pretending, and Violet really not realizing it was thief. So we see them both with the same kind of They've learned in the same way. They both disguise and rob. They're both prepared for violence. And so we see the similarity between these beggar thieves in training and the members of the Thieves Guild. All right, I'm going to restart. This is chapter 5, page 42. Next morning was like any other one of the hundred or more Gord had spent in the beggar master's house. It seemed that way at least, until Gord began to notice a certain tension written on the face of Fergo. Rasp, Will Weiner, and other masters. None of his fellow students seemed to notice, but Gord was more aware of small signs and body language than the others. He had turned out to be, as Clyde had predicted, the star pupil of the lot, even if Gord himself didn't realize it fully yet. Break. All right, well, now here we're given a few more characters from the Thieves Guild, but one of the most important things about this paragraph in the relation of Gord is that we are not given how much time has passed between Gord being sold and Gord being the star pupil and seemingly acting older, more confident, more authoritarian, perhaps even a little jaded over being looking down upon things like vegetable stew and beer for his food when he would have been happy with the terrible weevil filled biscuits and thin vegetable broth that he was being fed on in the workhouse, or worse. And here we're given that Gord has been at the beggar master's house for 100 or more days. So we have a time of really 3 to 4 months that this change has come over Gord. Now, he still would be fairly young. I mean, he goes in as a small 12-year-old, and at most he would probably be, a very early 13-year-old, first beginnings of a teenager. But there really is no childhood, for him, and probably for anybody among the lower classes in the Greyhawk. In the city of Greyhawk. So at 13, a lot of cultures would be having him come into the early manhood. So Gord is showing signs of that, that he is going from his orphan childhood fear days to becoming a much different person within a few months here, within 3 or 4 months, where he is now becoming confident and older, attracted to Violet. So things have really changed here for Gord. We see here that he's also, again, why he is the star pupil, because Gord is able to see tension of the Gord is able to see the tension that he is of in the instructors like Fergo, Grasp, and Will Weiner, but he the other students are not. I'm going to restart. This is page 42, paragraph 2. As his feeling of unease grew, Gord wished more and more to have a minute to himself so he could find Violet's group and see what she knew. The morning training session seemed to drag on interminably, but eventually the time for the noon meal arrived, and he hurried to the cellar to get his food and see his companion of the previous day. Violet wasn't there, however. This wasn't unusual. The groups did not always eat at the same times each day, because there wasn't room for all of them at once in the cramped lower chamber. Under the ever-watchful eye of Fergo, Gord could not duck away to look for her, much as he wanted to. Break. All right, now here we get a little more description of the mansion of the beggars, of the beggars' union. Here we have that the cellar is not only where the kitchens are, but where they come down to eat their food. But it is not such a vast place that it can hold all the groups at once. It's the cramped lower chamber. And we get a hint that something may be going on right here. But really, the most important thing that I find in this is there's a description of a morning training session, which again is only for the elite group, whereas the regular beggars are out there and working already. They're also, this midday meal seems to be only for the elite group, and that even among the elite group, there isn't a room for everybody down in that cellar kitchen area. I'm going to restart. This is page 42, last paragraph. He spent his mealtime idly eating, while again going over everything that had happened the day before. Then it was time for drill again, and after a seemingly endless afternoon session, Ford found himself the beneficiary of a surprise that he received with mixed emotions. He was feted by several of the masters because of his great progress, and the celebration was one that Gord should have relished. The instructors informed him that he was being moved from apprentice to least master, bypassing journeyman status altogether. This was an unprecedented advancement, but there was no great singing in Gord's heart at the news. He pretended joy and celebrated accordingly, but his mood was really dark and his spirit heavy. Something he sensed was wrong. Dizzy-headed and reeling from the wine he had consumed, Gord was shown his new master status room late that night. He fell into a drunken slumber and awoke the next day with a terrible taste in his mouth and an equally terrible hangover. Break. All right, well, this is a little bit of information about the Beggars' Union structure. Nothing too surprising. Apprentice, journeyman, least master. It's still now a master beggar, or beggar thief, really. We learn a little more about, it's hard to tell whether they would be celebrating everyone's advancement, and I kind of get the feeling that they would, especially anyone being moved up to the rank of master. But I get the sense here that it may not be something that happens just normally. Now, it is an extraordinary thing for Gord to go from apprentice, and like they're saying, within a few months he's going from starving orphan to now he is a master beggar thief. And all within a few months' advancement, really moving ahead right here, and really showing how exceptional Gord is. We show here that something, the first inclination that something is wrong, and Gord's worry about what has happened to Violet. We're going to restart. This is page 43, paragraph 2. Paragraph 3. The news came early that morning. The watch had found the body of the woman who was suspected of the murder of a man in the garden quarter. Whoever the victim was, the officials of the city were in uproar over it. The newly found victim had been beaten, raped, and then strangled, obviously the work of some of the many muggers who roamed the thieves' quarter. Break. All right. We know here that we hear a little more about the watch, not really much, but we also learned that definitely the Wizard's Hat Inn is in the garden quarter. Murder of the thief, or just if they didn't even know he was a thief, has caused an uproar. and we're given a more of Gygax's dark and adult graphic atmosphere that he has for the city, and we're taken how the what's happening, what kind of place the beggar master and the beggars union is with what has happened to Violet. And where the body is found is the thieves' quarter. So, I'm not sure if we the mansion of the beggar master is on the edge of the thieves' quarter or in the thieves' quarter. It seemed to be implied at one point, or whether the body of Violet was handed to the thieves, or what happened to her happened. I'm going to restart. This is page 43, and it is paragraph 4. The victim was Violet, of course. Ward had figured all along that Theobald would never countenance mistakes such as those she had made. Gord was also sure that the fat son of a bitch had been happy to perform the execution of the errant Violet, that the beggar master had thoroughly enjoyed the whole process. With a heart hard as granite, Gord bent himself to the day's activity. His vow to revenge Violet's degradation was nothing he needed to think about further until the opportunity arose. In the interim, he would simply work harder and get better at each and every skill he was given the chance to gain. There was no outing the next day, as had been scheduled. The word was that training was more necessary than the extra income gained from field operations. It was evident to Gord that this was a lie. After all, what better place to get true training and experience than in the field? Actually doing was much better than practicing with dummies and the like, no matter how clever the lesson. It was just exercise, not real thievery. Could the monster Theobald be afraid that his plot had been jeopardized by Violet's killing of that stupid thief? That he feared discovery was certain, or else he would not have killed Violet and left her corpse to be found by the watch. That was a dual-purpose ploy. First, it would take the search for criminals in a different direction. And who actually cared if a murderess was in turn slain? Second, if the thieves thought that some daring beggars had overstepped their bounds, they might view Violet's killing as an apologetic execution, intended to pacify the thieves. Accompanied by a temporary cessation of non-guild thievery, this would indicate to them that the beggar master had discovered the offenders and eliminated their leader, and all was once again in proper order. The fallacy in this line of reasoning was obvious to Gord, and he fervently hoped that Theobald would not also see it. The guild would not be concerned overmuch about the killing of a single thief, and a foolhardy one at that. Gord could imagine the leaders of the guild, upon hearing of Violet's demise, saying to themselves, "Does fat Theobald really think we care about that?" They would bide their time, giving the beggar master one last chance to change his ways. But if the beggar thievery did not cease altogether. Break. All right. Now, here we're given a little bit more about the training and a practical look at the value of actual experience over the exercise and the training that they are given. That reflects a real-world viewpoint, but it also reflects that you're not going to get experience in the game from training. You're just going to be able to level with your training, and that you're going to get your experience by going out there and doing, and in the case of Gord, thieving. Now, as for the story that's going on between the beggars and the thieves, it does seem surprising to me that at this point, the Thieves Guild, Gord assumes that the Thieves Guild is pretty much aware of the beggar thievery going on already, and that you know, there it's not this secret that you know, Theobald went to the point of murdering the ex-thieves he had hired as trainers to keep that secret. But here it seems like that the thieves simply know about it already, at least in Gord's estimation. And so far, Gord's estimations have been very good. It also shows the kind of society that is in Greyhawk, where the death, the watch, and the Thieves Guild would not be overly interested in the death of one thief, or the revenge death of his killer, or the death of a young girl, that of no known in family or status within this society. So, you know, it shows again a very grim city of Greyhawk here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 44 and paragraph 3. When a week later the Beggar Master's corps was once again sent into action, Gord was jubilant. He did his best to steal everything valuable, not so valuable, in sight. He brought in a record haul, and for it he was given hearty congratulations by all the masters of the beggar thieves. They said openly that another trip such as Gord's today would certainly be sufficient to make him a full master, bypassing the interim rank of associate. Gord only smiled inscrutably. He knew what the results of the activities of the corps would bring. Break. All right, well, I mean, we see that Gord is planning his revenge, and that his revenge, he knows that his stealing more will work against the beggar master, or at least he thinks so. But we also see that we're also given a little bit of more structural information about the beggars' union, that the masters are broken up, that the comment before about a least master, that was an actual another rank in the beggars' union, least master, and then associate master, and then finally full master. So we're seeing, given a little more information about the structure of the beggars' union right here. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 44, last paragraph. The hall was in absolute chaos the next morning. During the night, a notice had been pinned to the front door by an assassin's dagger. It read, "Theobald and all those scabs falsely trained by him and his dogs are recognized and hereby given due notice that their lives and property are forfeit to the whim and execution of the Thieves Guild. Beggars seek a new master. All those loyal to Theobald prepare to die. Arentol, Grand Guildmaster of Thieves, Greyhawk and its territories." No one thought it a joke. Break. All right. Here we're introduced to Arentol, Greyhawk and territory, Guildmaster of Thieves. We're also, this does solidify that although the beggar master thought he was keeping a secret, here the Thieves Guild right away knows what has been going on with the training and the development of the beggar thieves. And obviously this, from what it says, this has caused chaos amongst the the members of the Beggar Master's mansion right there. I'm going to restart. This is page 45. It is paragraph 3. Beggars were immediately placed under a state of siege. It astonished Gord that Theobald managed to hold the loyalty of so many of the members of the Union. And it somewhat mystified him that there were persons around who were obviously something other than beggars. The hall swarmed with men in mail, robed clerics, black-garbed assassins, and even a handful of magic users. Gross master of monstrosities must have thrown wide his coffer lids to pay for the likes of these, Gord mused. He was certain that there were few beggars plying their trade anywhere in the city. He would be willing to wager his small store of hoarded coins that none wore the wooden hand symbol of the Beggars Union around their necks if they did dare to appear. No more cash would flow into Theobald's treasury until this matter was resolved, so the beggar master had better have deep chests of coin for his hired swords and spellcasters. Break. All right, well, here we see the beginnings of this conflict between the Beggars Union and the Thieves Guild, where the mercenaries have already been brought in. Fighting men, men in mail, robed clerics, assassins, and magic users. So the basic classes, and it really does start a very nice little enjoyable campaign in the city of Greyhawk, the Beggar Union Thieves Guild conflict right here. Obviously, as Gord is thinking, the Theobald must have a well reserve of cash. And we are given here the first mention of the wooden hand that is the worn symbol of the members of the Beggars Union. So within the city of Greyhawk, when the Beggars Union is in power, then probably every beggar would be wearing a wooden hand symbol and a member of the Beggars Union. Because you could imagine, with Theobald's violent and sadistic inclinations, what he would do to any person trying to beg on their own. All right. I'm going to restart. This is page 45, the last paragraph. The Lord Mayor and directors of the city were turning a blind eye to the whole thing. After all, it was taking place in Old City's worst area, where the beggars lay between the slum quarter and the thieves' quarter. Besides, who among the directors would object to a war between beggars and thieves? Even the Guildmaster of Thieves, who was a director of Greyhawk, would favor this conflict. It would weed out the less hardy and the less skilled in the ranks of the guild, as well as get rid of a lot of the miserable beggars. The result would be a bigger share of the spoils of the city for each of the thieves who survived, and a correspondingly larger tithe to the guild from each of them. For once, the Guildmaster of Thieves and the Guildmaster of Merchants were in total agreement on something. And every honest citizen would only see good in such a struggle, with fewer to beg, fewer to steal. They too could but profit. As Gord considered all this, he began to wonder if the officials of the city wouldn't wait until both sides were deeply enmeshed, and then smash them both. For the meantime, there was nothing to do but practice. The masters were in conferences and council meetings most of the time, leaving Gord alone to do as he wished. He took the opportunity to keep honing his skills, for he saw much benefit in the mastery of them. There was certainly a score to settle, but more importantly, a livelihood to be earned. The easy life of thievery Gord had experienced was one that so far surpassed his dreams that no other goal had real significance. Break. All right, well, we see how we're introduced to the directors of the city, the Lord Mayor and the directors. We're given a little bit of location. The beggar's area lies in Old City between Slum Quarter and Thieves Quarter. We're given a little information, like I said, about the directors. The Guildmaster of Thieves, the Guildmaster of Merchants are both one of the directors of the city. There is a Lord Mayor, and at this point we're really not told really how the directorship or the mayorship is working within the city. We see that the open war between the beggars and the thieves is not looked down upon, that even the common citizens aren't worried about it or even deeply displeased about it. Everyone thinking that a whittling down of both or either sides, both sides or either side, would be a benefit, even to the common citizen. I'm going to restart. This is page 46, paragraph 2. For the meantime, pardon me. There's a little description here of Gord continuing to hone his skills in this paragraph. Still wanting to settle the score, but he does realize that the life he has been recently living is much better than anything he'd dreamed about before, and he has been quite the success. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 46, paragraph 3. The end of this idyllic period came in a fortnight. Beggars not ensconced within the safety of Theobald's walls were beginning to disappear, and some have been found dead, murdered in various ways. It was time to strike back, and Gord was to be part of the special force the beggar master was sending forth to counter what the thieves were doing. The fat lord of the lowly understood that he must somehow settle this matter quickly. A protracted conflict could have only one end. Theobald opened the deepest recesses of his headquarters. There was a hidden sub-basement beneath the place, and from it passages led in all directions. There was egress to the sewers also, which meant that there was a low road to nearly everywhere. Mercenaries and beggars would form teams for their retributive strike. The specially trained forces of the beggar master would disguise themselves as various ordinary citizens. Nearby would be the hired swords. When a thief was spotted, beggar scouts would finger the victim, and then follow so as to keep track of him or her. At first opportunity, the thief would then be taken hostage or slain. Hostages, Theobald stressed, were most important. Any skilled thief must be captured and brought back to the beggar master's mansion, if at all possible. Each scout group consisted of a master and an apprentice. As a least master, Gord was a master nonetheless. He and Sam, a boy of no more than 10, but nearly as large as Gord, were given the mission of going all the way to the river quarter, the strip, an area running from Dockside to Low Street, was notoriously wide open and roisterous. Rivermen in barges, riffraff and ruffians, soldiers and sailors, all congregated there for fun and entertainment. Body houses and taverns abounded. Gambling dens were nearly as common as saloons, and saloons were everywhere. In such surroundings, it was only natural that swindlers, cheats, and thieves would abound. And in fact, while the headquarters of the Thieves Guild was in the Old City, the group's main base of operations was centered on the Strip. Gord and Sam would simply be two more boys in the crowd, there for entertainment, or whatever else they could manage. Break. All right, now we see how they're planning on striking back at the thieves. We are given some of the plans on how they may plan to do that. So if you're running a beggar thief war campaign, here's some scenario ideas. But we also have a little bit more description of the city of Greyhawk. We have talk about the river quarter, the strip within it, Dockside and Low Street, and as named areas, named streets, and a little idea of what is on them and who that you're likely to encounter. Body houses and taverns abounded, gambling dens, saloons were everywhere, rivermen, bargers, riffraff, ruffians, soldiers and sailors. So it is a very boisterous area, very rough. And in fact, as they say, the Thieves Guild is headquartered in the old city, but the main base is right here, the river quarter, the strip. We're introduced to the character Sam, who you know, is an NPC. And again, if Gord is only 12 or 13 and San is 10, that the beggar thieves seem to be an awfully young group. All right. I am just about done for the night. It is close to 7. I am going to end this recording right here. We are ending on page 47. And next recording will start with page 47, paragraph 2. Thank you very much.